There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey there, I'm Jason Gotts, and you're listening to Think Again, a Big Think podcast. Started in 2008, Big Think is a kind of online think tank of big ideas from some of the most creative thinkers on the planet. On the Think Again podcast, we revisit these ideas in new and unpredictable ways. Our producers surprise me and my guests with short interview clips from Big Think's archives, ideas that we didn't come here expecting to discuss. I'm very, very happy to be here today with two guests for the very first time in the history of the show, over 100 episodes, Nicole Galland and Neal Stephenson. Nicole is typically a writer of historical fiction and some contemporary fiction, including The Fool's Tale and Iago. And Neal Stephenson is known for complex, mind-boggling, speculative science fiction, including Seven Eves, Snow Crash, and many other novels. Together, they've written a new novel. It's called The Rise and Fall of DODO, which is an acronym for Department of Diachronic Operations. It's a massive and massively entertaining epic involving magic, time travel, quantum physics, secret government organizations, and an ancient banking family called the Fuggers. That's spelled with two G's. Welcome to Think Again, Nicole and Neal.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, so glad to have you. So this is the, you guys have written, you worked on one other book together, but this is the first one, I guess, where you're the only two co-authors, right?
That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about like how that goes, because I mean, it's a little mind-boggling to me, and I know there's a bit of it on the back of the book about how you did this, but how do you go about writing a book of this size and complexity together? It's over 700 pages long. It involves multiple characters, multiple kind of voices and formats. Where do you begin?
Well, Nikki and I have known each other for a while, and we had worked together previously on one other book, so I think we kind of had a sense of how to work together. And in this case, we began with a pretty clear idea of what the overall arc of the story was going to be, who the characters were, what kind of people they were. You know, we keep joking that we need to make up a bunch of stories, a bunch of fake drama, so that we could tell entertaining tales of how hard it was to work together. But you know, it was easy. In general, Nicole was kind of the pathfinder on many of the major sections of the book. And so she would produce chunks of it and email them to me, and then I'd make my pass. And then as far as the overall, the complexity of it was concerned, we just used really prosaic things like spreadsheets to keep track of what happened when.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it was quite harmonious, and harmony doesn't make for good anecdotes.
Well, that's okay. We don't necessarily need you guys at each other's throats. But I guess what I don't understand, you know, Neal, you say you started with a pretty clear idea of the story and the major characters, but that had to start from somewhere. Like, did one of you come up with that, or did you sit down in a room and throw ideas back and forth before you got to that? And then secondly, sort of two-part question, when you guys get down to the sentence level, are there sections that are written by one person and sections by another, or are you guys like co-writing or rewriting each other's sentences? How does that go?
So maybe I'll take the first half of that and Nikki can take the second half.
That'd be great.
The basic idea for the universe and how it worked is something that popped into my head for some reason on a Thanksgiving morning. And then there was a few months during which the overall story, sort of who did what when, was being kind of refined just by kind of kicking it back and forth. So, you know, I think that by the time we actually dug in and started working, it was a reasonably well-oiled pitch, and we both had a good shared vision of who the characters were and what the basic plot points were going to be. The opening sort of third of the book has a very clearly laid out, first this happened and then that happened kind of structure when we started writing. And then, as I said, Nikki tended to be the person who broke trail on a lot of the major narrative sections.
Yeah, so generally the way that we would work is I would start out doing a big chunk of something, and then, which very often included establishing the basic voice of the narrator for that section, because as an epistolary novel, it's told in many different voices, sometimes long-form narrative, but a lot of other Slack chats, emails, I was going to say recipes, but I don't think we actually ended up with recipes, but all sorts of various ways of telling the story. So with the, especially with the first several voices that are introduced who tend to do the long form narrative, I sort of set those voices. But then when I handed them off to Neil, he adjusted as necessary. There were other voices that he established and that I adjusted as necessary. So both of our fingerprints are really all over it. I think that people that are familiar with both of our styles could probably go through and like guess, oh, that must have been Neil. Oh, that must have been Nikki. But generally, we were not. There was no proprietary attitude about anything that was going on at all, really.
It's, you know, the result is wonderful. I mean, first of all, it's a lot of fun to read. There's a lot of humor throughout. You have a great time with the acronyms.
Well, thank you.
I was laughing out loud at the section where, you know, the secret government organization starts to become a little nervous about the ridiculous acronyms that the linguist is coming up with. But I want to dive into a little bit the world that you've created here. You guys have basically healed the ancient rift between magic and science, or, you know, fantasy and science fiction, in a sense. Can we talk a little bit about how that works? I mean, this kind of quantum physics of science and how that all works in the novel?
Sure. I mean, it's a minor spoiler, but I think anyone who reads the jacket copy can kind of see that coming. So I don't see any reason not to dive into that if you've got questions.
Well, no, I mean, that's my question. I just wonder if you could sort of, if you could unpack a little bit how that works and what it meant to you guys as writers to bring together the idea of, you know, fairly well-established concepts of magic with quantum physics, Schrodinger's cat in one universe. Yeah.
So there are some really troubling, puzzling features of quantum mechanics that have bothered people ever since they were discovered. And so Schrodinger's cat is an example. It's a thought experiment that illustrates some of those paradoxes without really answering any questions. So there have been a bunch of proposals to try to explain those mysterious features of quantum mechanics. And some of them get pretty weird. And one of the weirder ones I used to think was the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which I think started with a guy named Hugh Everett in the 50s and was seen as being completely insane at the time and totally unsound, but actually is being taken more and more seriously in recent years. And the gist of it is that you can explain a lot of the mysterious features of quantum mechanics by just positing that there are basically an infinite number of parallel versions of reality that all kind of exist close to each other and kind of run in parallel, and that what you're doing, what quantum mechanics is doing, is kind of averaging over similar universes in a particular way. And that sounds kind of nuts because it leads to this huge proliferation of universes. But if you can get past that, it does a pretty good job of making the paradoxes and the hard to understand things of quantum mechanics just go away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a thing that I started learning about a few years ago when I was working on Anathem. And, you know, it turns out there are people who think about this and write about this. And there are people in the field of metaphysics who think about alternate worlds and the theory of alternate worlds and what that means. So it just seemed to me that that it was a way, as you put it, to kind of heal the rift. And that in a kind of lighthearted and humorous way, not in a terribly serious way, that we might be able to say, well, you know, maybe magic, you know, never was a mystical or supernatural thing at all, but
right.
It was just some people figured out a way to leverage this many worlds thing and sort of move between parallel universes in whatever way was convenient to them.
Which you know, makes sense, because science looks like magic if you don't know what's going on, as does technology, so.
Yeah, so it just seemed like a fun hook for a story, you know.
At the risk of getting like too deep into quantum physics, I do have a question that maybe you can help me resolve, which is, with Schrodinger's cat, I understand quantum physics on the quantum level. Like, I can accept that particles don't behave, you know, in Newtonian ways, like at the level, at the subatomic level.
Yeah.
But the idea of the macro world and cats and humans and the narratives of our lives existing in parallel universes, like, I don't understand how that would work. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that makes it paradoxical and hard to understand, is exactly the problem you just mentioned, that we can accept it at the level of elementary particles, but it doesn't make any sense when we try to apply it in the case of macroscopic things. And so that's what has occasioned a lot of the philosophizing and thought experiments around quantum mechanics, and people have different explanations of why we don't see quantum effects happening on a, you know, basically in large, warm, wet objects.
Right.
But it's still an open topic of discussion. I mean, people are seeing now quantum effects happening in big, warm, wet things like, there's a navigational system that birds use to figure out which way is north that appears to leverage quantum effects. There's indications that the olfactory system uses quantum effects and that there may be some features of the brain that work that way.
Huh.
So it's still an open question and a really interesting question, you know. And I don't mean to suggest that we're like addressing all of that in a terribly, terribly serious way in this book, but it gave us the kind of the leeway to start playing with it.
No, the book is like multiple genres in one. It's, you know, it's got a very, it's very plot driven, but at the same time, it raises a lot of interesting questions, and you know, maybe this is Nicole's historical, you know, writing background, and I guess also theater background, but there's lots of wonderful texture from Elizabethan England and, you know, 13th century Constantinople. I guess it's Constantinople still, right?
Yes, yeah, Constantinople. Yeah. I'm more comfortable, obviously, in the historical stuff than I am with the science, but it's very fun to have the leeway to play around with the intersection between science and history. Magic is almost the perfect place to live, to put those two things together.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful and wonderfully specific mashup, I mean, that you guys have going on multiple levels. And, you know, it's one critic, I think, mentioned, you know, the Jason Bourne series, because there's also the sort of, I don't know, spy thriller aspect of it as well. It's really enjoyable on all those levels. So I think this would be a good place, given our timing and everything, to transition to the other part of the show, which is sort of a intellectual surprise grab bag, where we're going to have some conversation starters that aren't necessarily directly related to the book, but might bring us back to it or to writing or to interests of both of yours or not. But there are three short videos. What we do is, you know, we'll watch the first one. They're basically interviews from Big Thinks Archives. We'll watch the first one, then come back and start a discussion wherever we begin. So let's start with Salman Rushdie. This is Video Games and the Future of Storytelling.
The game that my 13-year-old boy Milan and his friends all seem to be playing right now is this Wild West game called Red Dead Redemption. You know, and one of the things looking over, I mean, I don't even pretend to understand what's going on really, but one of the things that's interesting about it to me is the much looser structure of the game and the much greater agency that the player has, you know, to choose how he will explore and inhabit the world that's provided for you. You know, he doesn't, in fact, doesn't really have to follow the main narrative line of the game at all for long periods of time. There's all kinds of excursions and digressions that you can choose to go on and find mini stories to participate in instead of the big story, in the macro story. I think that really interests me as a storyteller, because I've always thought that one of the things that the internet and the gaming world permits as a narrative technique is to not tell a story from beginning to end, you know, to tell stories sideways, as to give alternative possibilities as stuff that the reader can in a way choose between, you know. I've always thought of the Borges story, The Garden of Forking Paths, as a kind of model of this. That, you know, the Garden of Forking Paths is a story, is a book, whose author has gone mad because what he's tried to do is to offer every possible variation of every moment. You know, so boy meets girl, they fall in love, they don't fall in love. That's the first fork, you know, and he wants to tell both those stories and then every variation of every moment down both those lines. And of course, it's like nuclear fission. The possibilities explode into millions and billions of possibilities, and it's impossible to write that book. But it seems to me that in some ways the internet is the Garden of Forking Paths, you know, where you can have myriad variant possibilities offered at the same level of authority, if you like. So I mean, I think that's one of the ways in which storytelling could move. And these games, these more free-form games in which the player can make choices about what the game's going to be, you know, become a kind of gaming equivalent of that narrative possibility.
It feels in a lot of ways, I mean, obviously, I think we both agree with him. And in many ways, Dodo is almost like an origin myth for what it is that he's talking about, because one of the underlying premises, which is how we fold the multiverse concept into the story, is that there are different strands of time that each possible iteration of the universe exists on what we call separate strands. And each time you attempt to go back into the past, you risk being on a different strand than you were before. So in a sense, he's describing what we actually have going on in the story. Because we have a novel that is written and printed in a book, we can't explore all of those things to their logical conclusion, or even their illogical conclusion. But we definitely sort of set the stage for the sort of thing he's talking about.
Yeah, so our premise was sort of the rules of the game as we've set them up is that you can't just go back in time and alter one thing and actually have a definite effect on the present, because there are many different strands that are sort of alternate pasts that all kind of get to vote on what their shared future is. So it's a little bit like we're doing what Salman Rushdie's talking about here, except backwards, going the other way back in time, having to go down many forking paths into the past and take some action in each one of those forks in order to bring about an effect in the one present reality that we live in.
It's a very, very subtle reverse engineering.
Yeah, I mean, I guess... How do you, as maybe the answer is spreadsheets again, but how do you as a writer, sort of not go mad in the Borgesian sense, trying to contemplate all of those alternate possible realities. I mean, it seems to me that writing a novel or writing anything really, there's a certain amount of control that you're exerting and that you're wanting to exert in order to sort of lead the reader. And indeed, your book has a narrative line and it leads the reader in a particular direction. But, you know, when you're dealing with something this, with all of these alternate possibilities, yeah, how do you not go mad?
Well, one thing we're claiming in the book is that the witches who know how to do this, who know how to do magic, have got a way of keeping track of this stuff. And it's not perfect, but it's a sort of calculation device that they can use to make kind of seat of the pants calculations that narrow down the possibilities quite a bit and give them a clue as to what they should and shouldn't try to do. And then again, because it is a book, we get to just tell the parts of it that are going to make for an enjoyable story. And so we don't have to go down all those forking paths, but we imply the existence of a huge government bureaucracy whose purpose is to worry about all that stuff.
I mean, do you think that it sort of fundamentally changes, or maybe compromises is too charged a word, but the nature of story and narrative to have, like in a video game context where you might have not infinite, but many, 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 many possible futures, do you think it's even sort of fair to think of that as story anymore?
I think it is. I between the two of us, I probably have the more conservative notion of what a story is because of my theater background. You know, a play is a much more conventional and linear storytelling style where you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think it's harder for me to break out of that, and I have broken out of it very happily in this case. And I think that's partly because if you hearken back to really old school traditional storytelling where people would gather around a fire and swap stories, you have, for instance, Greek mythology, where there is no single linear narrative that takes you through the entirety of the Greek pantheon. But there are many, many stories and many characters, and everyone interacts in different ways. Not that we're quite as infinite as that here, but we could be. The setup is there to go in that direction.
And even theater, you know, is kind of moving in a direction now, or maybe this isn't even a new thing, but you see things like Sleep No More in... Do you know about it?
Yeah.
You want to say a couple words about what that is as the Shakespeare geek?
I haven't actually seen Sleep No More, but it's been described to me multiple times, and I would love to see it. You walk into an on-site, I think it's a house. I think it was originally done in a house or a small apartment building, and there are various elements of the story of Macbeth being enacted in different places. And depending on where you wander around, you get the story in different ways, in a different order, from different angles. I was actually in a production of Richard II in college that did something similar, where we sort of led people around through a Harvard dorm. So yes, that's definitely an experimental element to theater. But even back in the 19th century, I think. Oh my God, I'm about to date myself. Not that I'm from the 19th century.
Yeah, I was going to say.
there's a play that I wouldn't call modern. I'll just leave it at that. Called Wojtek, which was originally intended to be performed, where all of the scenes would be put into a hat, and they would just pull out a scene number, and then that would be the next scene that was performed. And then another number would be pulled out, and that would be the scene that was performed. But there is definitely a proliferation of that now compared to the history of theater. And perhaps it's related to just the zeitgeist changing with the advent of things like video games.
The thing is, like, I feel like there's this tension always in literature and storytelling between wanting a cohesive narrative that pulls you along as the listener or the reader, and wanting to sort of dwell in, you know, characters' thoughts, in moments, in a sort of non-linear way. You know, and I feel like if you've got multiple plots going on at the same time, that potentially thwarts or frustrates whatever that hunger is for linear narrative clarity, that satisfaction you get when it's like, oh,
yeah. I think that you can actually have a happy medium between the two, which we happen to do in our story. So I'm a fan of this particular style. There are many different voices. There's many different ways it's told. And if you stick with the long form narrative, you mostly get to have a traditional linear storytelling experience. So you could, if you needed to, sort of brush through some of the other things and you'd still get the basic story. But if you want to dwell in the tributaries of the story, that's available as well.
We're also making a positive effort to kind of go there. We've been working with a startup called Bound, which is at getbound.io. They've released an app that's designed for enjoying narrative content textually or on in audio form, related to kind of big worlds, sort of gamey type worlds. And so we've begun to release some, there's a term called equals. It's not a prequel, it's not a sequel, but it's an equal, meaning a different story in the same universe that happens at the same time.
I see.
So these are meant to read like additional archival material from the annals of this organization, telling stories that involve different characters and different storylines from what is in the book. But it's clear from the book that that this is a big organization and they could have all kinds of different operations running at any one time. And so it's kind of a natural kind of story universe fit for the idea of exploring different concurrent storylines.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, so I mean, I guess that's in a sense a very natural thing in fiction where you're building an entire world, you know, that like, which is something that I know you do a lot in your books, Neil, that you create an opportunity for multiple simultaneous narratives, for the central narrative to be decentralized in some way because the world has, you know, it's all encompassing cohesion.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that sort of geeks love is that's the whole basis of Comic-Con and geek culture in general is the idea of coherent worlds in which they can go get lost. And it encompasses science fiction and fantasy and also historical fiction.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, so all three of those are genres where the essence of why it's exciting and interesting to read is that once you have gone into that world and sort of found your way around and you're looking at the maps and learning about the different characters, you're not limited to experiencing just a single narrative line within that world, but you can go back and read sequels and prequels and equals and stay immersed in that world. You know, it's the whole basis for the Marvel universe and the Lord of the Rings universe. And you
Yeah, I recently reread Lord of the Rings with my 9-year-old son and was yet again struck by the incredible, you know, specificity, not only in inventing languages and races and all of those characters, but in the detail with which he describes the physical landscape. And so in that sense, it feels like Tolkien was really a pioneer of all that. I mean, just talking about, you know, the types of trees, the, you know, they're literally 60% of that book must be landscape.
Yeah. And landscape and walking. Yeah. And, but it works.
Yeah, it works. So I think what we'll do, let's do one more clip. And I think let's do Robert Sapolsky on Brain Regions.
So when we look at the world's ills, one of the biggest sources of it is us failing to do the right thing when it's the harder thing to do, giving into temptation, giving into impulse, giving into emotional sort of immediacy. And the part of the brain that's most central to whether or not that happens is the frontal cortex. most recently evolved part of the brain. We've got more of it proportionally or more complexly than any other primate species out there. It's the part of the brain that does impulse control, long-term planning, emotional regulation, does all the stuff where it's the frontal cortex that whispers in your ear saying, do you really, really want to do that right now? I might not do that. You're going to regret it. It seems like a great idea. Frontal cortex about that. Okay, so when we look at our moments of life where there's that enormous temptation to do the impulsive thing, and what's going to determine whether the world will be freed of impulsive horrors if only we can all get stronger frontal cortices trained in childhood to be able to hold out, where you can have one marshmallow right now, but if you wait, you can get two later, and training from early age so that your frontal cortex has the most like fabulous aerobic metabolism ever, and it could just make you. And what the studies suggest is at all sorts of junctures of doing the harder thing, yeah, having a really robust, studly frontal cortex may do you a lot of good there. But when you do sort of the truly difficult thing, when you see people who are the ones who run into the burning building to save the child in there, leap into the river when everybody else is standing there like headless chickens, when you look at those people, they're not doing it because they've got the most amazing frontal cortexes on earth that could reason through the long-term consequences of, oh, what if nobody in society came to the aid of strangers? What they do is they do it automatically. When we do our most amazingly, like, wondrous altruistic acts, it's not because we've got the most incredible frontal cortexes on earth that could, like, reason us. It's because it's out of the realm of the frontal cortex, and it's out of the realm of temptation and limbic stuff. We do the harder thing in a case like that because, for us, it's not the harder thing. It's become automatic.
There's a few things going on in there, but like initially it sounded as if what he was, to me, as if what he was saying was that like lack of impulse control is responsible for, you know, many of the horrors that we perpetrate. Although to me that like historically, and I don't know, from what I see contemporaneously, I would say that humanity perpetrates many horrors through carefully reasoned long-term planning.
In a very premeditated way.
Yeah.
One of the things that we fall back on a bit in the book is using the lawful or chaotic, good, neutral, or evil from Dungeons and Dragons. Not directly. I actually, I'm not sure that we ended up citing it in the book at all, but you can really look at how a lot of the characters and the forces work through that filter. Lawful does a lot of good and evil, but so does chaotic. And I think the chaotic is the one that operates without the frontal cortex in place.
So you heard it here first. The neurologically informed reading of the Dungeons and Dragons character matrix.
explain it a little bit more to me, though, like the lawful and chaotic. Because so when I was in fourth grade, believe it or not, the kids who were playing Dungeons and Dragons were actually cooler than I was. So I wasn't allowed in their group. So I don't remind me of the lawful chaotic division.
Well, it's just it's a 3x3 grid that kind of, it's useful in Dungeons and Dragons for rapidly slotting a character into a particular way of being, but it turns out to be great for real life too. So the one axis is just good, neutral, bad, and the other one is lawful, neutral, chaotic, or, well, it's lawful and chaotic. I can't remember what the
one in the
middle.
I'm not sure that there is one. I think it's two in one direction and three in the other.
Oh, okay.
It's been years, though, so I might be off on that.
Yeah, okay. I had it in my head as a 3x3, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so, like, you know, lawful evil would be a Nazi. Not like a street Nazi, but, you know,
an actual member of the Third Reich government.
Right, and you can kind of figure out the rest from there. A lot of our characters, the witches in the book, tend to be chaotic. They're not subscribing to any one particular, they do what they want to do, pretty much.
And they're neutral as well. They're chaotic neutral. There's no...
Yeah, I will say that Erzsébet Kárpáthy is wonderful, a wonderfully unpredictable character.
Thank you. She's fun.
But at the same time, she's kind of to the point in the video, she is super conscientious about certain things that issues that we're not even aware of. So she'll like murder people without worrying about it a whole lot. But there's certain boundaries that she understands you're not supposed to cross when you're using magic. Kind of to Zapolsky's point, these are just so obvious to her that she has no patience even trying to explain them to mundanes. It's just like totally obvious. Yeah, I'm not going to waste my time trying to explain it to you people.
I think that that's a great place for us to leave it. Neil Stevenson, Nicole Galland, it's been really great talking to you about your book,
yes,
The Rise and Fall of Dodo, and I wish you a great rest of your day in L.A. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've enjoyed it. Yeah. Thanks.
And that wraps up another episode of Think Again. I hope you're enjoying your summer, and I hope that this show has been an enjoyable part of your summer. I know that these conversations for me just keep getting better and better. And I have this idea, which I mentioned at the end of the last episode. I'm thinking of starting a Facebook group for Think Again, where we can continue the conversation. And bring together a lot of the amazing people who are listening to this show, many of whom have written to me at my email address, jason@bigthink.com. Feel free to write me. Let me know if that's something you'd like. If you'd want to join a Facebook group, send me an email or tweet at me at BigThinkAgain. That's our Twitter handle. And we'll be back next week and hope to have you with us.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Thank you.